Hypos. So, years ago, back when I was doing research stuff, and using statistical models as a way of trying to explain human behavior, which is complex, there's a kind of principle of parsimony. So when you're mapping all the complexity of human behavior, all things being equal, you would prefer a simpler model to a more complex model. Yeah. But you don't want to get too simple, right? You don't want to get too simple as we can be. In spiritual practice, we are very attracted to parsimony, simplicity. It's almost like we want our practice to be about one thing. But the more I explore this path of freedom, the more nuanced it seems, the more multifaceted the path seems, the more multifaceted the expression of freedom seems. And I've come to think of spiritual maturity or awakened life as a kind of collection of many skills, of much beauty, of some grace. But it's not easily captured. It's complex. And sometimes we tend to put all of our eggs in one basket. And we do this a lot with the topic for today, anatta, not self. And I consider it a kind of cruel irony that the mention of the topic, not self, causes a spasm of self in most practitioners. Yeah. Maybe you felt that spasm already, It's one of the best topics for that. So we want to watch this, yeah? A Dharma talk is just another practice period. And a friend of mine said that she said the sense of self is experienced as tension. Like that's its fingerprint. And so we watch that where there's a kind of a caution I'm making to yeah, we honor the teaching, the Buddha's teaching around not self, but we are careful not to diminish the other dimensions of freedom, not to get too simplistic in our model of spiritual freedom. Now, this is confusing territory, because our thoughts and imaginations around this theme of not self, they're essentially fantasies about the self getting better. Yeah. The self becoming dignified in some new way, honored, yeah. But the self is like a project that never gets completed, yeah. Yeah. And comes in like way over budget, like $1 billion over budget. It's also very easy to get philosophical about this and kind of trying to almost think our way into the insight. And the Buddha said to avoid the thicket of views. This is not a philosophical investigation. And the Buddha said a position, the Buddha said, is something that the Tathagata has done away with. Referring to himself. A position is something the Buddha's done away with. And in the end, really, you know, who cares whether there's a self or no self? Who cares about almost anything? I, in the end, really only care about suffering, yours, mine. So we don't get lost in the kind of philosophical musings around this. Anatta is right here. It's right here, in this moment. Like from the Tarigata last night, like the path is not a straight line. You enter from anywhere. And anatta is right here, just obscured by clinging. Our habit, our deep habit is anatta, one of the three characteristics, dukkha, anicca, anatta, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, unreliability, and not self. And our habit is really to suppose the opposite of the three characteristics. To fantasize about a durable pleasure that might restructure our lives. We fervently hope to tie up all the loose ends of being human. And this kind of fantasy I have of just like holding the world still, getting it to how I want, and then just holding it still. To game out samsara, to manage uncertainty, maybe to live forever. We suppose the opposite of Nietzsche. And we fantasize about taking refuge in an identity. The urge to possess, to have, to hold. And so we're encouraged, given that our default is to assume something like the opposite of what the Buddha suggested, we're encouraged to look more closely and to look in new ways You know, how do we see in a new way? Maybe you know the experience. It happens most with people with whom we're most familiar, maybe people we love most. And over the years, it's we get so familiar with them that at some point we really stop looking at them, or at least stop seeing them. And we get so the shorthand of our concepts, we become so encrusted in that. It's almost like the being of the other is just encased in the concepts. And in this way, we turn them into a thing. And the sacrifice that happens is that the intimacy and spontaneity that can occur when we really look is sacrificed, because the thickness, the density of all the concepts just take over. And then maybe if we're fortunate, at some point, we might have a moment where we look deeply at them. And the question is something like, who are you really? You might have known them for decades, but we can still ask the question, who are you? Who are you beneath the layers of my concept? And just as we kind of freeze the being of another into an essence, into a caricature, we do that even more so with ourselves. And so we want to look. We want to look. Now, important to say that there's no tension between what I'm beginning to point to in this teaching on not self, no tension between that and a very warm, gentle, tender, loving relationship with oneself. We get the sense of like the teachings on not self are somehow like vanquishing the self, where there's some kind of opposition between confidence, between anatta and self-love. And so we really should clarify like what's being negated in the not of not self. Much confusion arises here. So we're not erasing the complexity of our psychological conditioning. That's not what the teaching on anatta does. And we're not erasing the reality that identity, how one is perceived by others, exerts enormous effects, historically powerful effects, right? The You know, it's like identity might be empty for the Buddha, but it's definitely not empty for the racist, yeah, for the misogynist. And so the ways in which others fixate identity in who they see has profound effects, often tragic. And so this teaching on not self is not dismissive of this reality. And we're not, you know, every teaching can be used or misused, can be a tool of liberation or a way of rationalizing our neurosis. And so we're not misusing the teaching of anatta to deny or, you know, bypass is the language that John Wellwood used originally, spiritual bypass. We're not using this teaching as a way of bypassing our own needs or dependency, you know. The Dharma is a lot about becoming more and more independent of conditions, but we actually have to honor our dependency too. And so sometimes, like going on a kind of hunt for ego or something, and that really just creates more duality, more separation, more friction. So sometimes I say, like, self is an experience and not self is an experience. And two experiences don't contradict each other. I prefer to understand something like a continuum of the density of self. And on the one end, on the far end, there we find both arrogance and self-hatred. And arrogance, self-hatred, like neither actually can really be sustained under any kind of deep investigation, the deep fullness. They're very fragile constructs. Sometimes they're almost like the flip side of a coin, you know, that even in self-hatred, self-hatred is just sometimes another kind of grandiosity, another kind of holding ourselves to some totally wild expectations or perfectionism or something. These are fragile forms of self-identification, very dense. And then we maybe move closer to something like self-acceptance, self-love. And self-love, to love oneself, is not to cherish or elevate oneself, but to really to accept ourselves, you know, to have a kind of loving, patient acceptance of ourselves, to honor our conditioning. Yeah, so what I'm saying is really that self-love is not a form of arrogance. Self-love is an expression of non-clinging. Yeah, to like really to really open to let go, to release clinging with respect to ourself, is it, we kind of develop incredible tenderness for ourself. And it's not the self-love of like, I'm so good, or any of that kind of thing. It's just like this open-hearted acceptance of the messiness of being a human. And the self that is loved is much easier to forget than the self that's hated. Yeah, the self that is loved, we're starting to move across this continuum from arrogance or self-hatred into self-acceptance, self-love, to self-forgetting, to letting go, to the emptiness of self. And as we move along that spectrum, we find, yeah, the self that is loved is easier to relinquish. The self-hatred, self-harshness makes it such that to surrender into the stillness, to the silence, it's self-hatred makes that feel less safe. Yeah, it feels like there may be some monster kind of lurking. And so we come in this path of practice, we develop so much acceptance, so much forgiveness, yeah, like forgiveness for ourselves. So what does fall away? What is the not in not self referred to? Well, self-view, sakyaditti, and a more subtle kind of self-making. That usually the language I think is conceit. And these are two processes that we investigate as practitioners. And so I'll say a bit about each here. So this self view, personality view, we tend to assume stability of the self, and yeah, there's some interesting research when you ask people like how much they think they'll change over time. People tend to tend to underestimate how much they'll change. And so in one study, the authors concluded with this line. They said, people, it seems, regard the present as a watershed moment at which they finally become the person they will be for the rest of their lives. History, it seems, is always ending today. Yeah. That sense of like, oh yeah, I've arrived. Here I am, Matthew of December 2020. History ends now, yeah? But then we evolve, right? Our life is only ever arising and ceasing, but there's enough momentum and continuity that anicca gets disguised you know, the same things keep arising. There's continuity there, but we have to look closely to see the discontinuity. So we're counseled to see that even the well-adjusted self, even the self where there's a lot of acceptance, a lot of love, even the well-adjusted self carries a burden of dukkha. You can kind of like never take refuge in ideas of the self. There's always some measure of alienation. It's like sometimes I think of it as it's like when you're practicing mental noting, yeah? And it's like the note that's not quite right, yeah? And it just feels off. And it's like the self is like that always. The self-view, like the ego being stimulated, it's such a dominant force. Like so much of papancha, so much of mental proliferation is really kind of accessorizing the self. And even the sense of our past, of memories, like how do memories leave a trace in our mind? And my sense is the memories that leave the deepest traces are those that stimulate the ego. And so you sit down, maybe you sit down after a day of, if it were not in retreat or something, after a day, and there's like all this stuff to be digested, all the ways the ego had been stimulated through the day. And then that stimulation of the ego becomes a kind of memory. And we have to digest it or forget it or somehow move on. But we can wonder what would it be like to move through life, to move through experience without all the titillation of the ego that requires a certain kind of tending to it. It's like a wound that just does not heal. And so we find ourselves kind of like tending to this. We have very rigid ideas about who we are and who we're not. And we're very, very moralistic about this, you know. It's not an accident that our species has gravitated towards moralistic religion. Very moralistic about who we are, who we're not. It's kind of like all the pros and all the cons of Matthew. And just saying that out loud makes me a little nauseated, you know. But we have these ideas of what makes us of value, what's a cause for shame. And then we kind of establish the egoic ground, and then we stand guard at the gates of self, patrolling, for the guests, the honored guests that affirm my ideas of who I am, and those intruders who might challenge But it requires us a certain kind of vigilance, of standing guard. And this becomes the kind of reference point for how we move through the world, of just everyone, everything kind of pinging to the cell tower of ego or something. You know, what does this mean? What does this mean for me? Does this confirm or deny my idea of who I am? So, the psychologist, Buddhist teacher Paul Fulton said, being successful offers no immunity against the ongoing measuring of ourselves relative to others. Just because one can compare oneself favorably does not stop the process of comparison, and only partially softens the sting, because the pleasure of feeling superior is always precarious, subject to being erased with one untoward interaction. Once this comparing mind arises, it threatens to negate any nourishment we may have gained from our accomplishments. Self-esteem is in constant renegotiation, never a truly finished product, immune from fluctuation. It can kind of sense the fragility of the self system. And there's no question that there's some pleasure, egoic pleasure, narcissistic pleasure, the pleasure when self-view is working out okay, but it's a very fragile pleasure. And it means that if we live by the ego, we die by the ego too. And so we're invited to find a different refuge, to not try to build our safety out of the house of self. And this happens over time. As we practice, we gradually we begin to drain all of the emotional charge from our definitions, from the pros and cons of Matthew. It's like all of that arises. We sit, we walk, we practice, we interact, we have sangha, we have meetings, we do all these things. And it's like, yeah, the self gets stimulated, and then like kind of air out of a balloon, we just stay with it until that the kind of emotional charge of it is diffused. And this creates a lot of safety, a lot of safety. Now, there's a subtler sense of self, maybe closer to conceit, and that's a whole other topic in a way, but I want to say something about this. A subtler sense of self that is forged by thinking, forged by unconsciousness, forged by taking something to be ground, taking something to be the center of our being, taking something to be the perspective from which we view. And the center to which all experience points back. Shinzen Yang said, spiritual practice is a sequence of acclimatizations to a progressively less fixated and more attenuated sense of self. So this is pointing to not just to the ideas we have, the pros and the cons of me, but the actual sense of the congealed self. And we want to investigate, like, what is it that feels like the center point of my being? How does the self congeal into a thing? So we look, what is this? Like we get stiller and we look, like, how does the sense of I am-ness arise? And we start to see that it's out of a kind of tangle of phenomena that we don't appreciate as phenomena. We don't appreciate as anicca. We don't see the flowingness, the changingness, the emptiness of those experiences of subtle kind of thinking and feeling. And we have the kind of perception of, like, oh yeah, there's a Matthew within Matthew. That's who, like, receives experience. That's who's giving this talk. And a sense that it converges in a point. So this, often share this quote from a philosopher, Dennett, to ask, like, what is a self? And writes, I'll try to answer this question, what's a self, by developing an analogy with something much simpler, something nowhere near as puzzling as a self, but has some properties in common with selves. What I have in mind is the center of gravity of an object. This is a well-behaved concept in Newtonian physics, but a center of gravity is not an atom or a subatomic particle or any other physical item in the world. It has no mass, color, or physical properties at all, except for a spatial location. It's a purely abstract object. It is, if you like, a theorist's fiction. But it is a fiction that has nicely defined, well-delineated, and well-behaved role within physics. And then he goes on to say that the self is the center. I really love that language. Like, the self is the center of narrative gravity. You kind of can feel that sense of, like, oh yeah, it all pools up in some center of gravity in our being. And what's being highlighted here is that center of gravity is made of narrative, yeah? That's what feels like the home base of our being. That, like, subtle voice in our heads that feels like the perspective from which all experience begins. And so it says, our tails are spun, but for the most part, we don't spin them. They spin us. Yeah. The scholar Olensky put it differently, said, the self doesn't do the grasping. The self is something done by grasping. Yeah, the self is something done by grasp. And so we might ask, like, who are you when there is no clinging? Clinging is what makes experience dense, what gives it its ground. But what happens when nothing is setting off even the quietest alarm bell, when there are no problems? In a way, if there are no problems, if there's nothing besieging the heart, there's no need to perceive, even no need for a view, certainly no need for a self. And maybe you notice sometimes, like when it feels more and more safe in meditation, the more and more the self thins out, the more you can forget yourself. So we sit there and the self kind of recedes. Oh, I feel safe enough here. I feel safe enough with this sangha. I feel safe enough in my body. I feel safe enough in this moment. And we get more, our inner life feels more and more safe, and the self starts to feel to thin out more and more. And then maybe something frightens you, a sound, and all of a sudden we're put back into the corner of ourself. The self becomes denser. And so it's plausible that, that this fixation of the self is orchestrated, hallucinated as a way of staying safe, as a kind of expression of our own self-preservation, that the self becomes the kind of place for looking out, the watchtower. But if you're unafraid, you don't need a watchtower. Of course, the world is not safe, and that lack of safety is apportioned very unfairly. None of this is to deny that. But maybe practicing together, there are times when some of the fear begins to melt away. And we start to see the ways that the self is not a cause, but an effect of fear. It's an effect of fear, and it's also in part of what makes death terrifying. Because when we are imagining death, we are imagining death from the perspective of self. We imagine the destruction of the self. But the Buddha says we're protecting a phantom. So we start to see the anicca, the impermanence of this ground, of the watchtower. Anicca has a kind of undertow. It starts to pull us, starts to pull our world into its flow. and experience thins out, the air gets thinner, that language acclimatizing, like to an altitude, different altitude, the air is thinner, the self is less fixated, more attenuated, feeling more like space. And we no longer so much attending to objects. The object becomes the field of awareness. Like that's what's held consciously. And as this starts to happen, the awareness, we don't realize it, but the awareness has always tasted like me. Yeah, that's a very strange way of putting it, but the awareness has tasted like me. And then it becomes tasteless. Tasteless. And there's no center and no periphery. No here or there, self or other, but there's still knowing. Another philosopher described some of this as like, what's the least we can be aware of? What's the least we can be aware of? What's short of cessation, but very thinned out? And the answer he offered was there's a kind of wakefulness. And he used very nerdy philosophy language, called it unpartitioned epistemic space. Unpartitioned, no divides, no edges. An epistemic, like the capacity to know, the potential to know. This heals a certain alienation, the sense of self, ego, conceit. It pulls us out of the world in a sense and makes us look like we look to the world from outside of it or something. And then we realize, maybe suddenly, like the world, we are the world, the world's inside us. There's no banks in this river. Tsokhni Rinpoche said, not dwelling in any way whatsoever, and yet totally present throughout everything. This is a cooled out way of living. It's a cooled out way of living, but it is not ethically neutral. And there's strong connections between some of what I'm describing and the care we've been detailing. The center is empty, but the heart is full. Just sit for a moment. So thank you for your attention. Please take what's useful and leave the rest behind. A couple announcements. Meg will be offering some practice discussions to full reading and the sign up list is on the page, the main page. And for the auditors, Inez has a drop-in group tonight, and the same thing, link is in that main page. So yeah, nice to be with you, and may we all be happy. Yeah.